Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. It's Thursday, March 5th, and we are going to start with Senator Latz. Senator Latz, I'm sorry we kept you waiting the other day, and now today, and I guess senators are just big lunch eaters or something. I'm not sure, but...
Madam Chair, I don't object to lunch.
So, Senate File 106.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present to you Senate File 106. I do have an author's amendment. Maybe we can get this in shape first, then I'll explain to you the reason for the bill.
Senator Sparks would move the A1 amendment, putting the bill in the shape the author would like. Any questions? I want everybody has it in front of them. Just so then members on the author's amendment offered by Senator Sparks, the A1, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Okay. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You may recall 2 years ago I appeared before this committee promoting what I had dubbed the Car Buyer's Bill of Rights, which included a provision that was a two-day return policy for buyers of automobiles. And the idea for that bill, which ultimately was not successful in becoming law, was derived from a California law that had been passed, and also from anecdotally that there had been some similar issues or complaints in Minnesota about experiences of people who bought cars and within a day or two attempted to return those cars and were unsuccessful in doing so. So I contacted the Minnesota Attorney General's office to ask for information about that, to see what kind of data they had with regard to number of complaints, the nature of the complaints, how they got resolved, those kind of things. And I was met with a response which has basically prompted this kind of a response from me. They don't keep aggregate data, or at least were unable to share it with me. My understanding is they did not keep aggregate data with regard to any particular types of complaints. What data they had, they were unable to share with me. Other than sort of the broad outlines anecdotally, they were good enough to contact two individuals that had complained of this issue, got their permission to speak with me, and then I followed up with those two individuals. Unfortunately, neither of them were willing to come forward to testify publicly regarding their experience as well. So what I was left with was basically anonymous anecdotal information to share and no statistical support or aggregate data that I could use in support of my bill, conversely, as might have been the case, been that there were only two such experiences that were came to the attention of the Attorney General's office anyway, the response might have been statistical support for the opposition of my bill, which was, this really isn't a problem. It happens maybe a couple of times, but it's not an issue, and here's the data that shows it's not really an issue. Well, this committee was left with, and what I was left with as an advocate, was an absence of information upon which to make well-informed public policy decisions. We didn't have the data that could say this change in the law would be helpful, this change in the law is not necessary. So it occurred to me that what we really need is a more aggregated set of data, the statistics that would help us make those kind of decisions, the legislature as a whole, as we're making public policy decisions, rather than simply relying on the aggregate, the anecdotal data, or someone having an idea from a constituent and not having any support one way or the other, or relying upon the Attorney General's office to decide, here's something which we think we want to bring forward, but we don't want to bring forward those other things. As legislative policymakers, we want to be in a position, I would think, of being able to look at consumer complaint information and say, there's a problem here, we should step forward and fix this problem with the law. Or we may decide, as we look over data, there isn't a problem here and we should reject a proposed change in the law. Either way, it'd be good for the public policy body here in Minnesota to have that information. So hence you have this bill, which would provide for the Attorney General's office to aggregate the data that they receive. They are among the few agencies in the state that receive most of the consumer-oriented complaints or inquiries. A consumer has a questionable or a bad experience, the Attorney General's office does broadcast or publicize with flyers and other information that they can receive and help resolve complaints. This database would not be specific to individuals, so you wouldn't be able to get names and addresses and phone numbers, but it would be able to tell you that you were categorized in certain areas, what's going on. Not all the complaints of consumer issues come to the Attorney General's office. There are some go to the Department of Commerce, particularly with regard to insurance problems, and there are some other places those go. But the Attorney General's is one of the go-to places for consumers when they need help, and this would help us as policymakers decide what steps we might want to take after that.
Senator Latz, I know when I signed on the bill, I mean, I was struck by the need to know that. I mean, this committee is Commerce and Consumer Protection, and you're absolutely right. They get, I'm sure, the lion's share of the calls with consumer concerns and complaints and other kinds of issues. Senator Olson, were you going to say something?
Madam Chair, you read my mind. You must have known
I was
going to
watch your eyes, Senator Olson.
Well, I just was going to add that I would strongly support this bill as well. I remember last year when I carried the wireless bill, you know, that it was really necessary to have someone from the AG's office come to every committee hearing to be able to testify because there was no data outside of having them available as a witness. And because it was left specifically to that very not material that was publicly available, it left it open to challenges, probably maybe even more than it deserved, but it kind of created some apprehension in relying on the statistics. So I would think that this would be helpful not just to consumers. I'm sure it's mainly directed toward, you know, consumer protection, but I would also think that it would be helpful for those in business and industry to see if there are trends with problems. That's something that's readily available that they could try to address before they might be subject to a lawsuit or something. So I would think this would be good for in both directions.
Okay. Senator Latz, do you have anybody to testify on behalf?
I don't.
In addition to the chair and Senator Olson. So I know that there's someone from the Attorney General's office.
I don't, but I do want to acknowledge Senator Gerlach took a particular interest. He's a co-author on the bill, and he's had some suggestions about how to write up the database information, and I appreciated that input. Wish you were here to hear that.
I'm sure he'll be here shortly. Is Mr. Gilbert?
Yes,
there he is. Until I said your name, I didn't see you. Welcome to the committee.
I was hiding back there.
Well, I know you were hiding there the other day, too.
Yes,
I'm sorry you had to wait.
No problem.
So, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Gilbert. I'm with the Minnesota Attorney General's office. And I'm here on behalf of the office just to express some significant concerns regarding the benefits and utility of this particular bill, especially in light of the substantial resources that will be necessary to actually implement the bill. I've already expressed these concerns with Senator Latz, and I think a very constructive setting, and I appreciate the opportunity now to express those same concerns to this committee. I would divide up the office's concerns in a few different areas, one being the public policy aspect of this bill. Complaints, by their very nature, are subjective. And I would say that they're extremely subjective. You have to look behind the complaints to understand what the significance of it is and the import of it is. Just because there are complaints that exist or that there's a certain number of complaints doesn't necessarily mean that there's a problem in an industry. And conversely, if there's no complaints, it doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't a problem. And as I say, you need to dig into the background of these complaints and the I would submit to you that the aggregate data that would be provided under this bill could be very misleading and could be a source of alarm for the public in terms of a particular industry, and at the same time, it could be a source of security for the public, which at least seems to present a problem in terms of the public interest. In terms of what the Attorney General's office presently does, what the office does in terms of keeping records in a database, we have never in the past served as a clearinghouse for consumer complaints. So the office is not set up right now to do what's provided for in the bill. Rather, the information that the Attorney General's office has is used to determine what law enforcement action should be brought. And it's not based upon aggregate data or numbers of complaints. It's based upon information that we have and that is assessed and analyzed in accordance with the law. And based upon that, the Attorney General's office, therefore, uses the information it has to decide which cases to bring and which cases not to bring. The Better Business Bureau, as you well know, serves as a clearinghouse. And it provides the same or similar information that provided for the bill. I also note, and I've discussed this with Senator Latz as well, that the legislature already has access to complaints through constituent services, and I really am not familiar with what kind of database capability that you now have, but that is another source of information. In terms of the fiscal impact, we have prepared a fiscal note that I trust the committee has access to.
Do we have it?
Am I correct in that assumption?
Mr. Gilbert, I don't know that we have received one.
And I have to admit, I don't know how fiscal notes work in the sense of how they're disseminated.
It may have gone to the Judiciary Committee because that's where this bill will go.
Okay.
We
have prepared a fiscal note. Have you seen it, Senator?
I have.
Okay. And because we just don't have the capability at the present time to do what's provided for in the bill, we would have to have systems changes, software changes. There would be increases in personnel required to do the coding and things of that kind. And seeing as how you don't have the fiscal note in front of you, I can give you the bottom line that the estimated cost over the biennium is going to be $1.37 million, according to the fiscal note. And frankly, this raises questions in light of the fiscal impact, whether the incremental utility of this database is sufficient to justify that at this point in time. Our office receives between 500 and 800 calls a day from consumers, many of them registering complaints, about 100 to 200 letters a day, most of them registering complaints in some form or another. With the economy the way it is, those numbers are just increasing, and they're increasing rather rapidly, and we expect that that will continue. Obviously, I don't have to tell you, you know, better than me as to, you know, budget situation with the state and decreases that budgets, that agency budgets are taking, and thus far the AG's office is no exception. We don't expect it to be an exception. So the fiscal impact is significant, and I'm sorry you don't have the fiscal note in front of you. I really don't know what the reason is for that.
Yeah, Mr. Gilbert, I think we understand that there would be a need, obviously, for software, you know, those programs, and that there would be staff requirements. I think we get that. We don't, since we're just policy committee, I mean, we have to take that into consideration. And if this were the only committee that we're coming to, then we would be sending it to finance, but I believe the judiciary probably will be the place where that happens. So, but I understand. Is there anything on the list? Or were you finished?
Actually, I wanted to point out
couple
of what I would call technical issues that I see with the bill that I think highlight some of the concerns that I've expressed, some of the public policy concerns. But, for example, the bill talks about listing the types of consumer goods or services provided. Many of the complaints we receive are not a result of the actual purchase of the consumer good or service. For example, a consumer might buy a particular product, and they're happy with the product, they're happy with the representations made to the consumer when they bought the product, but some private information is nonetheless later sold to somebody else, for example. That's a common complaint. The complaint has nothing to do with the actual purchase of the service. It's just kind of a byproduct of it. We get a lot of complaints about collection agencies. So when consumers call in about that, they're not complaining about the product or the service that they purchase, but they're complaining about how a collection agency has reacted to them because they haven't been able to pay for the service. And it goes on and on, the different kinds of permutations and variations that can apply. So I think if this bill were to pass, or I do think there should be some technical changes in it just to accommodate the situation we're talking about here. It's not as simple as the bill would suggest. Another example of that is the reference to statutory or other basis for complaint. I understand statutory basis, and one thing I want to note in that regard is that when you look at the statutory basis, and all of you are very familiar with that, there's very descriptive on the statute number as to what the statutory violation is. For example, I've got here 325.67, which is entitled False Statement in Advertisement. 325D44, another very common one that is a basis for consumer complaints, that's entitled Deceptive Trade Practices. And then another one, very commonly used as well, is 325F69. It's called Unlawful Practices. And subdivision 1, for example, is entitled Fraud, Misrepresentation, Deceptive Practices. What I want to point out in this regard is, to the extent this consumer database would list the statutory violations with respect to a particular industry and the number and that kind of thing, what attaches to those statutory violations are these descriptions. And the office, in most cases, in trying to resolve these complaints, is not adjudicating that someone is engaged in fraud or is engaged in misrepresentation. And if this database were out there and we're dealing with these businesses trying to get them to informally resolve cases, but yet if there's a resolution, it's going to be categorized under a category that at least suggests they've engaged in fraud or some sort of deceptive practice, I think that's going to cut back on our ability to resolve some of these issues. So if this bill passes, I would hope that that would be taken into consideration so that we don't have to deal with that kind of ramification. In addition to that, in terms of the technical issues, there's a reference in here to the statutory or other basis for complaint. I'm not sure what the other basis is. Now, we do get a number of complaints from people who say, I bought this product, and I'm trying to get a hold of the business, and they don't call me back. Or other customer service things, which aren't necessarily and typically do not lend themselves to a statutory violation. So I'm not sure what the basis would be under the law for that. I don't know how we characterize that. But we do get complaints, many complaints of that nature, and how we deal with them, I'm not sure. The reference to the resolution of the complaint. This, again, goes to the unique nature of each of these complaints. Sometimes a consumer will call in. All they want is a call back, or they want an apology. There is no resolution in a legal sense under these statutory provisions. And whether you want to know all that or whether that's helpful to you, I think that should be considered as part of this bill. Again, if it's going to proceed, I just think it needs to be refined, taking into the consideration some of these issues. So that's all I have. Again, our position is that we question the utility of it, the benefit of it, in light of the subjective nature of complaints, and especially in light of the cost that would be associated with this.
Mr. Gilbert, if I might ask something, a couple of things, and Senator Latz, you might plug in here, which I'm sure you are, but I'm understanding that not everything has to do with something, the product, or necessarily even, you know, like, I mean, a cleaning service or repair service or something. It could be that it's a complaint about collection agencies, which would be nature of businesses. And I was wondering if you shouldn't maybe put an or there, just because it's probably one or the other. It's probably a problem with the product. And, Mr. Gilbert, wouldn't that, I mean, like, wouldn't you say that I have a lot of people behind me? I can tell.
They're cheering loudly, yes.
Wow. Wouldn't you say that, for example, collection agencies, that would kind of be the nature of businesses? I mean, you're getting, 100 calls a month about collection agencies calling at work or that kind of thing.
Yes.
And, you know, that's the kind of thing that would really be helpful to us to know as we're doing legislation. You said something about the company not calling back. Well, to me, that's another basis, if you will, kind of unresponsive or lack of customer service or, you know, that kind of thing where the company doesn't call back. And I understand those are kind of Better Business Bureau complaints as well. Do you ever refer people to the Better Business Bureau, or do you make references? Did you refer anything to them?
Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, we do not refer to the Better Business Bureau.
Okay.
But in response, Your Honor, I'm sorry, Your Honor,
right.
Mr. Court, Madam Chair, in terms of the reference to other basis, there's a statutory basis for a complaint. I assume that means, if true, it would violate this statute. But a basis for they won't call me back, there is no basis for that in the law. So maybe it's technical, but I think if we're going to do this, it should be done right, and it needs to be refined. Is my point,
Senator Latz? Do you have Senator Latz? Do you have any comments on that exchange?
Madam Chair, the categories are intentionally worded a little more broadly. I didn't think it was appropriate to put in statute or for the legislature to prescribe every possible category for entry in the database, because I don't have access, number one, to be able to make those kind of judgments. The Attorney General's office knows, you know, what the other bases are for complaints, so on. So I would anticipate that they would look at this and say, okay, we've got to have one column says statutory or other basis. And under other basis, they're going to say, okay, we get calls relating to lack of return calls from business. We get other calls relating to this or that or the other thing. And they're going to create their subcategories, their codes, to fill in those categories. I don't think we should be listing that. There might be some categories listed here that in a particular inquiry or complaint are not applicable. And I would anticipate they would put in that for that particular data entry, not applicable. We just can't anticipate how all of that's going to play out, and I think we ought to leave that up to whoever puts the database together to fill in those blanks.
Senator Olson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to say that, you know, among different branches of government, we sometimes, run into these little difficulties where we really all want to work together, but no one likes to have, say, one branch of government prescribing how the other might do something. What we're trying to do, I think, is to try to find something that will make this easier going forward in the future and not be as reliant on resources within the AG's office. For example, I know there was something I wanted to pursue this year, and I was simply told that wasn't going to be, you know, where the AG's office intended to put their resources this year because of something else they were going to be working on. And then without that kind of assistance, I don't have the statistical information available that I need to be able to move that forward. I know we do this in other areas, maybe not quite this extensively, but, for example, I know Commerce keeps track of, you know, complaints. I know that with human rights complaints, you know, that there's a requirement that there's information available that's tracked. And maybe somehow the middle ground here would be for the AG's office to come up with the format to be able to say this is the easiest way for us to keep, because I know they're keeping track of it to some degree already anyway internally. I mean, they have to be, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to come here and testify we've had the most complaints about wireless than anything else. So somehow they're already tracking that, and if we could try to work together to make this as simple as possible, I can't believe it's an insurmountable thing to do.
Mr. Gilbert.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we do not track complaints by number. We have the ability to do some word searching of complaint letters and responsive letters that we send back. And what we do as part of our investigation analysis of a particular issue or area is do that kind of word searching and pull up documents that might be filtered that way. And we can then perhaps, based upon a particular subject area, quantify the number of complaints that we received. And I suspect that in the situation you're referring to, that's what occurred. Now, I've heard you and Senator Latz mention that you'd like more information provided from the Attorney General's office in certain situations. I don't know that we couldn't provide that in form of some summary data in unique situations where you need it. The law provides for that. I don't know that it justifies, in light of the experience that Senator Latz had and perhaps the experience you had, an entire database of this kind at the kind of cost we're talking about. If we're talking about a need to identify some information in some circumstances, I think we should talk about that between our office and the legislature and compare it with what kind of information that the legislature might have through its constituent services as well. So I don't see any problem with that. I think it, frankly, is a lot less expensive, a lot less resource intensive. And I think it would get us to where I hear at least you and Senator Latz saying you want to go.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, to both the author and the witness, I guess I think I'm not sure if this is the most useful thing in the world, and I picture in a lot of areas when constituents call us with a problem with a product or a service, we suggest several things, and I suppose once in a while we suggest they contact the Attorney General's office, but I don't think it's not the first thing that comes to mind always. And so I don't know that saying you got 600 complaints about this tells us much, but nevertheless, I think Senator Olson sort of hit what I was thinking on the head, and that is that I don't think we need a very complex complaint database. I think the Attorney General, this may require that, but I don't think that's what we need. I do think that somehow or another, at least generally tracking what is happening, that I would assume the office, at least somebody writes down, had a complaint about this and sent them a letter back or whatever. I mean, I think that this is a lot more explicit and specific, and therefore I see why it has a big fiscal note on it. But it seems to me that the compromise is sort of what Senator Olson said, and that is maybe you keep better track of it and let us know. But if anything, if you wanted to pass a bill on it to just direct the Attorney General to keep track of consumer complaints and how they're resolved and whatever information they think might be useful, sort of what she said, have them figure out how to classify things and how to report to us. But I think it's a good idea that they try and help provide useful information to us, but I can see why Mr. Gilbert thinks this would be a explicit database. It would take a lot of time, and I assume it's not what Senator Latz was intending either. I think it's more just general, let's get some more information about what's happening in various types of products and services and so on.
Senator Latz and Mr. Gilbert, probably in that order, I mean, do you think you can work something out here that would work for legislators who have a need to get the kind of information the Attorney General's office would have? Obviously, we understand the privacy issues. We're not looking for who. We're looking for what and how many or how much. And do you think there's anything, Senator Latz, have you thought about any other language that, could accommodate? I mean, this is pretty specific. stuff. And I generally really support our being able to have access to more kinds of more information, for example. On the other hand, you know, Mr. Gilbert's saying, well, we can already do that, but I think some of our experience has been that we haven't, and it's not a particular complaint about this attorney general, it just kind of happens all along the way. So that's why I support, you know, went on your bill, because I think we need to move in this direction. Have you thought about making it less specific or onerous in terms of actually requiring, you know, a statutory reference? I mean, I understand you don't require it for everything, but that kind of stuff is... We could probably figure out a statutory reference ourselves if we saw the complaint, you know.
Well, Madam Chair, a couple of responses. One is, I in the particular idea that I had that I was dealing with a couple of years ago, I asked for exactly the kind of information which Mr. Gilbert is now saying and some senators are suggesting ought to be forthcoming from the Attorney General's office on request of a member of the legislature. And it was not provided to me. I was told, we don't have that. We can't give it to you. So I was at a dead end right there. And I don't know if Senator Olson had the same experience or not. But the broader problem with that is it relies upon us to come up out of wherever we happen to get ideas to bring forward proposed legislation or look into it further. And my whole idea was for us to have a statistical database that we could look at on an annual basis or whenever and say, there are some ideas evident from the statistical database that suggest we might want to make some changes in the law to protect consumers in this particular way. Not rely on us individually to, you know, to learn that California has a bill of like this and let's see what the issue is here in Minnesota. You're doing research on an area, you want the information to give you some guidance. If we don't have the information, it's completely random then what we come up with for ideas.
Mr. Gilbert, did you want to respond at all to that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just briefly, you know, with all due respect to my friend Senator Latz, I think that's an overstatement. The issues that are prominent as they relate to consumers, I think, are well known. They're publicized. They're prominent. There's discussions between our office and legislators about issues that are front-running issues. There aren't any real secret issues, as far as I know, that are going to be gleaned from a database of this kind. And as Senator Olson indicated, our office is more than willing and happy to work with the legislature on consumer-oriented issues. When I said that I think this information could be made available in response to your comment, Senator Olson and Senator Latz, I'm looking at the Data Practices Act, and in particular the definition of summary data and the preparation of summary data. And I think it provides for a response. Now, it does provide for the cost to be borne by the requester under the Data Practices Act. So, I mean, that's something in terms of cost, if it's a major cost, that I think our office would have to talk to the legislature about. But hopefully there wouldn't be a significant cost with requests that are made by the legislature in due course under existing statutory provisions. So in response, I think the existing legislative framework provides for that kind of access, and I would suggest that that's sufficient under the circumstances, especially in light of the cost that would be borne by this type of process.
Senator Vandeveer and then Senator Olson.
I'm going to pass, Madam Chair.
Pardon me?
I'm going to pass.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would have to say I have to sort of respectfully disagree with what you said about that kind of assistance being available. And I don't mean to point fingers because I understand that the AG's office has limited resources. But I, for example, wanted to continue re-pursuing the wireless bill that I pursued last year and wasn't able to get the support that I needed. One of the reasons given was that, you know, there just weren't going to be the resources were going in somewhere else this year. And if we don't have that kind of data available, As Senator Latz has explained, we don't have access to it because, of course, it's confidential information. So if we don't have some generic, non-identifying data available and there isn't a person that can be made available from the AG's office to help us, we're kind of stuck. And it just seems to me that it really shouldn't be just one office, like the AG's office, deciding what are going to be the consumer complaint, you know, the consumer protection issues that are going to be approached in a particular year. I mean, one thing we don't have in Minnesota, unlike some states, is we don't really have a generic consumer protection organization out there, you know, that kind of is a watchdog on behalf of consumers. We have a little bit of that with ARP and some other groups, but we don't really have anyone just focusing on that. The AG's office does get, I think, the lion's share of the complaints, whether rightly or wrongly. I think that's where they initiate. I guess what I was thinking here was just that maybe we could try to make this a little bit less onerous if we could get the AG's help with something that could be initially, you know, just one more screen to fill when that complaint comes in. We in the legislature have all heard the term death by fiscal note, and when someone doesn't want something to happen, it can suddenly be very expensive. But if someone does want something to happen, working with them and being flexible, a lot of times that cost can be managed way down and kind of worked in just as a part of the routine. I just wish we could work this out together so we could try to make that as less onerous as possible, but make this information available.
Senator Olson, I'll share with you my first experience. Fiscal notes were a very new thing in another lifetime. And my very first fiscal note said it would cost untold millions. So just they've refined the process since then. But that's a true story. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I had a fiscal note once on adding a member to an advisory council that had met like once the previous year. Got $1 million fiscal note. I was going to try and add certain economists to it, and they figured, well, if we were going to add economists, they'd want somebody to do the research, back it up. But Madam Chair, I think you suggested a few minutes ago something I think might be a good answer, and that is, I think, same thing Senator Olson's just been driving at, and that is that we should be able to get some more useful information here, and obviously some members of the committee and the legislature don't feel they're getting that. The Attorney General is saying this is way too onerous. I would love to encourage Senator Latz and Mr. Gilbert to sit down together and figure out how we can accomplish what we want to do so there's not a big fiscal note and so members of the legislature can get the information they need, because I think that is important. I think Senator Latz's proposal is doing the right thing. I'm not sure it's doing it the right way. And the Attorney General's offices are willing to be cooperative in that. So I guess I'm wondering if we could just ask the two of them to take a look at this for a few days and maybe reschedule the bill at some later time.
Yeah, Senator Marty, I think that that's I'd like the bill to leave here in a slightly different form. But Senator Latz, I think you've heard us pretty loud and clear from several of us. We are interested in going in this direction. So I'm going to lay the bill over, and I know you have another stop. And we must have 3 weeks or something. We'll get to it, but I'd really appreciate it, Mr. Gilbert, if the Attorney General's office, if you or others would sit down with Senator Latz and come up with something that isn't as onerous but gets us moving in a direction where legislators, you know, and I don't think we'll be pests. I just think there are times when we just have requests and we feel frustrated by not getting that. So I guess staff is telling me that maybe by the 19th, so that's what, a week from today? No, 2 weeks from today. So but we'll get you scheduled before that probably. But if you just sit down in this next week.
Madam Chair,
I'm going to lay the bill over Senator Latz, but yes, go ahead.
I appreciate the discussion with the committee. I found it helpful, and I hope that we can work something out. I think it would be unseemly for there to be the necessity for a member of the legislature to file a data practices request with the Attorney General's office every time we want information in a certain category.
Right.
So that I don't think I don't think Mr. Gilbert is suggesting that. He might have been referring to the statute just to recognize that there are some costs involved in complying with with requests for information. But we certainly don't want, I don't think, want to go in that direction. And I think we still need to wrestle with the question of how do we handle it when it's more than just an idea that a legislator has that we want information on, as opposed to having information available that we can review and analyze and decide if there's an idea we want to bring forward. Right now, all that information is in the Attorney General's office, and we don't have any access to it. There's some way we can find and make that information more broadly available so legislators or members of the public can look at that and can come up with ideas for legislation. I think that would be helpful, too. I'm perfectly happy to work with Mr. Gilbert to find a way to do that.
And Senator Letts, I might, and I know that there are some folks from the Department of Commerce here. I think it might be helpful to you, and perhaps they can be instructive on how, for example, their market assurance division works and how they get data to us or don't, but, you know, what kind of thing is available there, because it's a similar kind of transaction, if you will, that's coming to them or to the Attorney General's office. So thank you, Mr. Gilbert. Thank you for coming 2 days in a row. But I think I really hope you can work. I think that there, we think, I think it's safe to say the committee thinks that there is a way we can have a meeting of the minds here over this. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Letts, thank you. Mr. Gilbert, thank you. And Senator Dahl. So it's laid over. It's amended. No. I'm sure not. And Mr. Johansson's back again. Welcome. And
thank
Senator
you.
Dahl, I think we left. Did we finish the testimony in favor? Will you tell me where we are?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we just walked through the main parts of the bill. And there were a couple of you left at that time.
That's right.
Do we need to quickly go through the parts of the bill?
Members, if you weren't here, I can you just really briefly tell us what you're doing and why, and then and I don't, Mr. Johansson, did you testify on the, you were on the other bill, on the Dibble bill, so I can't remember in which.
Actually, Madam Chair, I was on both, but Senator Dahl had asked me to walk through the provisions, and that's where we ended, and so
thank
I wasn't
you.
Able to make my my
your testimony. Okay,
that's correct.
So Senator Dahl, pick up where you think we need to be and then turn it over to Mr. Johansson, and then we have several people also to speak.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And again, this bill is just a bill about accountability, transparency, promotes competitive bidding, ensures that health care dollars are indeed going to health care, and promotes for realistic timelines for bids and a fair mechanism should a co-op or school get out of the co-op. Again, much of this bill is based on a report from the state auditor back in June of 2005. And if you're wondering why we're acting on this now, if statewide health insurance for teachers, which had been on the governor's desk a few times since then, had gone through, this may not be necessary. So I'll let Mr. Johansson walk through again real quickly the key provisions of the bill.
Mr. Johansson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Lee Johansson. I'm with Education Minnesota, and I will make my my comments brief and hopefully understandable. It is the position of Education Minnesota that we would want the most secure, solvent insurance programs for the members of our organization. It's extremely important to us. Many of our members currently are insured through plans that are offered by the service cooperatives. And as Senator Dahl pointed out, the solvency of those plans and the stability of those plans was called into question by the state auditor's report. And many of our members have expressed great concern over the way that the co-ops operate, and those motivations are what's causing us to support this bill. It is to create a more secure, more stable insurance plan. And so the provisions, as we understand them, strengthen the plan. There is nothing in these provisions that weaken the plan. There's an issue that is addressed through the reserves. And currently, reserves for the co-ops are accounted for and attributed to each member district. So if a co-op pool insures seven districts, then there are accounted for seven different reserve pools. And what happens then if one of the districts were to withdraw from that pool and get their insurance elsewhere, that money that was reserving their insurance rolls into the co-op's funds and is done with whatever it is it's done with. We don't believe that that's right. We believe that, in fact, that money that was going to reserve District X's insurance, when it is no longer needed to back up the claims from District X, after all of the claims have been paid, the runouts have been taken care of, and the books have been closed, any remaining amount should go back to the source, back to where that was reserved. That doesn't weaken the reserves for all of the others that are still there. They're still as strong as they ever were.
Mr. Johansson, this point is interesting to me.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's money that was paid by the members who were insured.
Correct.
And when they left the pool, they had to leave the premium behind. Is that
If this was a fully insured product, there would be no claim to the reserve because that money would just go to that company and they would agree to pay. But it's not. This is a self-insured arrangement. And each individual district's claims and reserve are accounted for separately. Now, if they chose to account for the reserves pool-wide, then this would be a moot issue because then there wouldn't be any amount attributed to a local district.
Now, Mr. Johansson, did the state auditor comment on that piece?
The state auditor commented on the use of the premium money for non-insurance purposes, but did not specifically comment on this. They did, however, question the reserving of money. They felt as though it was not up to expected standards, that they were under-reserved. And, of course, that fluctuates from year to year as claims and things go up. But it is important to know, again, our goal is not to weaken the pool, but not to unduly enrich it at the expense of people who are no longer there either. And that's probably one of the most controversial pieces. Again, our members have lots of questions, and they find it very difficult to get answers. And so what this bill does is it establishes some procedures for reporting and accountability and transparency, because we believe that under the best-case scenario from our point of view, our members are still going to be insured under these plans for the next year or two. And so we would like to continue with that process. That's really the motivation, and I would stand for any questions, but I don't want to belabor the points longer than necessary.
I wanted to ask, there are people who have signed up to speak, and so we'll do that, but I was going to ask the Department of Commerce, is there something in the bill requesting them to report to us and... Then, let's just leave it there. And then, okay, Mr. Murphy, well, thank you for coming up because maybe that it's appropriate to ask you that now. I'm noticing on page 2, and I don't know if you can comment if there's other places that you need to speak to. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Kevin Murphy, Deputy Commissioner. The bill does require a report to the legislature every other year on the solvency of insurance pools. And you might remember that the Commerce Department's oversight of the service co-ops basically began during 2008 and will be intensifying a little bit going forward. We believe there would be a small fiscal impact to the department associated with monitoring these co-ops and also reporting. Beyond that, we don't have any comment on that particular
matter. But, Mr. Murphy, it is something that you do already, right? And not in this over the pools particularly, but you will be.
Madam Chair, we will be exercising some oversight over the pools, but we currently don't do any reporting to the legislature on our efforts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Murphy. I'm going to ask for Mr. Straczynski and then Mr. Brinkman, if he's here today. See us. Thank you,
actually,
Deputy Commissioner.
Maybe regulation seems to me to give them.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the service cooperatives.
insurance matters, and I have with me again Mr. Paul Brinkman. I'm sure we have no boards today. Anyway. We have
Pardon
no
me?
Boards,
oh.
drive pads, and whatever. So. But we'd like to share. We're
the people behind you probably are more relieved over that than we are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are opposed to this legislation and believe we already have certainly adequate oversight on all aspects of it.
Can you get the microphone a little closer, perhaps, Mr. Straczynski?
Madam Chair?
Yes, that's
better?
Much better.
Thank you. I simply said we are opposed to this particular legislation. It's directed at the service cooperatives only, not at other kinds of people who are self-insured funds, what have you. And Mr. Brinkman will testify as to the reasons, and I'll be available as a resource to answer additional questions. But we certainly believe, and I think it's safe to say, we have lots of oversight. We've had the auditor's report. We have met with Commerce. Every time people ask for information, we make sure that they have that information. I'll turn it over to Mr. Brinkman.
Well, Mr. Straczynski, I wanted to ask you, so do you feel that the service co-ops responded to the auditor? It's a state auditor's review, right, and report. Do you feel that the issues raised have already been addressed? Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think Paul deals with that in more specifics, but generally speaking, that report in 2005 was issued, and we followed. The auditor had several good recommendations, as auditors always do, regarding transparency issues and best practice issues, and we've implemented those provisions.
Okay. Mr. Brinkman, hello again.
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you again for your time this afternoon. My name is Paul Brinkman. I'm with the Northeast Service Cooperative in Mountain Iron, and I am pleased to hear part of Mr. Johansson's testimony today when he said that he expects his members to be in our pools for a couple of more years. I do appreciate that. I'm here today in opposition of Senate File 797. As public agencies, and we're actually local school districts, my particular service cooperative is ISD 697. The Minnesota Service Cooperatives welcome governance oversight, membership review, regulatory compliance, independent audits, and public transparency. Fortunately, all of these are already in place. Moreover, this proposal not only offers nothing new, but implies that our members have no stake at all in the process, supersedes the governing authority of locally elected officials, and holds Minnesota service cooperatives to unique, onerous standards uncommon presently in state statute. If adopted, it would strike a severe blow to the most successful model of shared services in the state of Minnesota. As required in statute, our regional boards of directors are governed by a majority of elected school board members. In other words, we are led by our constituents. In that same statute, Minnesota Statute 123A21, these duly elected governing boards empower various advisory committees, which include both labor and management, to monitor shared services, ranging from insurance to academic excellence to online learning. As products of our own membership, service cooperatives are voluntary, transparent, and competitive. Our revenues are returned to our members in the form of regional expertise, group purchasing, and shared services. In addition to ongoing member involvement and oversight, we answer to a number of state and federal regulatory authorities. Independent audits are published and on file with the state of Minnesota. As a public entity, we also fall under and welcome periodic review from others. For example, in 2005, the state auditor presented a series of best practice recommendations. We responded by asking for membership input and developing formal improvement plans. In fact, I brought mine today. We had a 4-page proposal, but I told our board we're going to take a year on this. We're going to run this report right up the flagpole. We're going to ask for people to come out of the woodwork. And we put it on every agenda we had for an entire year. We got some feedback on the negative side, and that's okay. Welcome to the public sector. But at the end of that, our member advisory committee, labor and management, signed off on the work of our improvement plan. Our board signed off on the improvement plan, and we moved forward. That was 3 years ago. Among our concerns, this new mandate now limits how our members and boards may use the administrative fees collected for the risk, expense, and effort of innovation. Please keep in mind that these fees have been fixed for 7 years and are often less than fees charged by brokers or agents, and they happen to be comparable to fees already charged by state agencies such as the Office of Management and Budget. Also, service cooperatives operate the insurance pools through enterprise funds, which are separately managed and audited. They're firewalled. They're not commingled with other operating funds. All co-ops have these in place. In addition to covering insurance-related expenses, the fees collected for administration fees help offset costs for services such as Knowledge Bowl, Spelling Bee, teacher training, and wellness initiatives. Most importantly, our advisory committees and board of directors have adopted a formal resolution outlining the allocation of these limited resources. That came at the end of our improvement process at Northeast Service Cooperative, for example.
Mr. Brinkman, if I might just ask you, that's money that's assessed separately, right? I'm reading what current law requires, and you can't take premium to use for administrative expenses already in state law. Am I right?
The way it, Madam Chair and members, the way it's set up is it's firewalled. Under our RFP, once the carrier is selected, the carrier administers the pool. At the end of that process, we do collect a 985, but that is administered by the carrier under RFP. In other words, our health and welfare fund, if you want to call it that, is not our checking account. That money is held under a different structure, the enterprise fund. Then we do collect the $985 per contract, and currently, under a legal opinion with our attorney, we're able to use that money in other ways, such as Knowledge Bowl, Spelling Bee, some of these other activities.
Would you tell us about a $985? I don't think I've ever heard that expression before.
If you're a member of our pool, for your monthly premium, $9.85 per month comes back to the service cooperative. But again, that does not come first. The claims administration begins in the enterprise fund, and that is administered firewalled by the in this case, Blue Cross Blue Shield, by the insurance company. And I could walk through that at the end of this if you'd like, because I've got a long flow chart if you want to go through the whole.
Senator Olson, we have a
question. Well, Madam Chair, I certainly don't want to say that I don't think things like Knowledge Bowl and so forth are wonderful things, but I can understand why teachers that are being overwhelmed with the cost of health care would probably want their health care dollars to go toward health care. And, you know, that school boards would have to look at those other kinds of programs within a different part of their budget. Whenever you've got the opportunity to either raise health care premiums or reduce services for health care because you can take that money and use it for something else that a local body might decide they want to use it for, whether it's county boards that can save money and use it for roads or whatever, you know, you're just having an invitation to drive up health care costs perhaps unnecessarily, and I think that's where there's a lot of concern, and I think rightfully so.
Mr. Brinkman?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, in our region, the lot of concern didn't come out of our advisory process. It didn't come from our board. That's the only thing I can tell you. Our members are aware of what we do and why we do it. Although your opinion makes sense, I just want you to know that in our case, it's not like we just take this money and use it whenever we feel like it. It's really part of how we operate, and our members are aware of it. And it frankly offsets costs in other areas of the services we provide. May I continue, Madam Chair?
Yes, please, Mr. Brinkman.
Thanks to your foresight, the service cooperatives are grounded in the very best of the public sector, transparency and local decisions, retaining the flexibility for our members to operate in their own best interest. When it comes to insurance, no one over the past decade has been held to a higher standard of oversight and compliance than the Minnesota service cooperatives. Ironically, although one-third of the teachers are presently covered in our plans, we've been singled out. Through it all, however, we continue to serve and to thrive, not because we have been micromanaged, but because we have been allowed to focus on our members, respond to the market, operate in the open, and present practical solutions for Minnesota school districts. I do want to talk about the reserves because that got some attention in the bill. If you look at Section 4.30, let me give you one example of how this plays out. As drafted, I'm not sure this is the intention, but it's not my job to question intentions, only to tell you how we're reading this.
Mr. Brinkman, you mean on like
page four,
line 30. Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair,
yes.
Members. Now, we track our member contribution to the reserves by year. However, you need to keep in mind that you see fluctuations annually as well as if you pick any arc of trend. So in other words, when you talk about reserves that are owned by a particular district, do you mean 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 7 year, 10 year, or since inception? Where are you going to cut that? But even if you're able to decide where you want to cut that, and you pick a time frame that all the members of the pool agree upon, here's how the language plays out. If you're the superintendent of Virginia, and you have $300,000 sitting for that time period, by the way, which was arbitrary. Because remember, 1 year back, you might have been at zero. 3 years back, you might be down $400,000. 8 years back, you might be up $300,000. See, you pick the eight-year marker, keep it standard, winners and losers, you got $300,000. Now, if you have Senate File 797 in place, you can take that $300,000 out of the pool, call a Twin Cities insurance broker, get a one-year bot rate on a predatory practice. Move out of the pool for a year, take the $300,000, put it into your OPEB account, and at the end of that year, if the pool can help you, come back, you've got $300,000 you took out of the pool, and you're right back in with everybody else. Everybody else is sitting there saying, wait a minute, what about my reserves? I can't leave because I looked at Brinkman's report, and it said we're at a negative loss over that eight-year period. Really, we have to keep in mind that this practice is not done in the industry. It's a moving target. It's an administrative cost nightmare, and it really amounts to adverse selection at the group level because those with positive balance at any arbitrary period can leave when they want, and they stick it to everybody else that stays in the pool.
Mr. Brinkman, I think we're getting the picture. I wanted to ask, I don't know if Mr. Murphy or Mr. Gross, somebody to say if this is done in any other form of health insurance. I certainly see, you know, problems with how far back you go. Senator Dahl, if you would.
Madam Chair, in the auditor's report that was put out, they did say that the reserve amount should be fully funded. It also went on to say that some of the co-ops could use the amounts they are currently spending from administrative fees and on non-insurance-related purposes to fully fund their reserves and provide better monitoring over the reserves and renewal rates. And I believe that once you get out of the pool, you can't get back in for
a year. I think I was reading. Well, is it 2 years?
There's a period of time. I don't.
It's for a period of up to 1 year. I'm reading here on page four, Mr. Murphy. Thank you for coming back.
Madam Chair, with respect to the item that starts at 4.30, our experience with the co-ops, which is not all that extensive, but what we've learned so far is that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, in the short term to allocate surplus to an individual participant in this plan, and it generally is not done in the insurance
industry. I was going to say, there is no precedent for doing that with other kind of insurance pools that we have.
Madam Chair, short of dissolving an entire insurance pool and letting it play out over a couple of years, it would be very difficult to sort out who belongs to what.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Senator Dahl or Mr. Johansson, thank you.
Madam Chair, on a quarterly basis, the service co-ops issue statements that account for each individual district member's reserve. This is not a difficult thing. It's done regularly under existing practices. What we're proposing doesn't have anything to do with a 5-year runout or a 10-year runout or a 3-year runout. What we're saying is that the amount of money that has been accounted for in that district's reserve at the time that they leave the pool, after all claims have been paid, and yes, it may take a couple of years to run that book of business out, but at that point, after all claims and liabilities have been taken care of, any leftover money will be returned to that district who's got that money under the service co-op's own accounting systems. It is really, when we ask, is this standard practice, in effect, that one district is dissolving its self-insured pool within the co-ops, which is provided for in existing law under, and if you look in the bill on page 5 at line 24, we have existing law that says how the reserves for a pool that dissolves will be dispersed. And all we're asking is that you use existing law and you disperse that money that's attributed to that district that dissolved its relationship with the co-op. It's not a complicated thing. It's not devious. It doesn't weaken the reserves that are there for the remaining people in the pool, the remaining districts in the pool. It's just giving back the money to those who paid it that's in excess. I was told by a service co-op business director this year they are not charging any administrative fee. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, one of our large districts withdrew from our pool last year, and so we're using their reserve to pay for everybody else's administrative fee.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I first became aware of this issue, it was a couple years ago when I was talking, I don't know if it was Mr. Johansson or someone else, about, you know, what was going to happen to the school districts if we created this statewide pool for insurance. And some of these school districts are in agreements with other government entities, you know, whether it be counties or cities or whomever, and that they were going to have to leave behind money that they'd had to put in up front to kind of fund their reserves to be able to be a part of this group. And so it seemed to me like, you know, that really, as Mr. Johansson said, if we're going to take school districts and they're going to put themselves into a big pool, they shouldn't have to forfeit money that they've either paid up front or that's still sitting there that would do nothing more than unjustly enrich these other groups because they haven't really contributed that money. On the other hand, I can understand if we didn't have a pool created, you know, where it wouldn't really be fair to have someone go in or out. And so my suggestion would be on line 4.28, if I'm not sure how the author feels about this, that we would just simply delete the words after coverage for a period of up to 1 year and the comma, so that basically if they went out, they could not unilaterally decide to come in. The sewer service co-op wanted them back. They still could because it says the service cooperative may prohibit their entry. But I think if they go out and take their money with them, I can see where there would be a good argument to be made that, you know, that they should be kept out then permanently. But I thought the real purpose of this was if we're creating that statewide pool to try to allow the districts not to be harmed as a result in terms of their reserves.
Does anybody want to respond to that? I don't know if you're offering that as an amendment.
Well, I would offer that as an amendment unless the author has an objection.
And Senator Olson, it would be on line 4.28, after the word coverage, strike for a period of up to 1 year.
Comma.
Madam Chair, we're okay with that.
Senator Dahl. Okay. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, do we have a copy of the auditor's report? It's really hard for me to understand the rationale for these recommendations without seeing that report.
Senator Dahl, do you have?
Madam Chair, it's about 150 pages. maybe 66 front and back. We do have a copy. I have an abbreviated four-page
summary.
Executive summary.
It might be helpful for members to see that. And Mr. Straczynski, you commented on some things that have been done in response to the state auditor's report. And we have roughly about five minutes here to move because Assistant Majority Leader Clark has a bill that's going to take a while, and I've scheduled the time. This may be something, Senator Dahl, that members would like to look at before we act on the bill. I'm wondering myself, and we probably should have read it, but I didn't know what it was. What the premise of the bill was, or what the reference was. But Mr. Straczynski, you did comment, or Mr. Brinkman could say what kind of response there has been already.
Madam Chair and members, there's been a formal response, again, adopted on the record by our advisory committees and boards. And in view of the time, I'd rather share that response with you so we can get you copies of what we have, if that would be okay. May I add one more thing on reserves, though, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Brinkman.
Again, whatever is done with 4.28, we're not certain how that impacts 4.30, and we heard the testimony from Commerce. We want to mention another view on this, because now I'll use real numbers, not what might happen, as I suggested, if this bill passes, not a conversation in a hallway. In our city, county, other governmental pool, in the last 2 years, our reform groups, we've had 8 groups leave, representing reform. They're small, right? 73 total contracts. They left $1.2 million in reserve liabilities. This is the environment we manage under today, and we make it work. And now this bill's telling us, I already know how to get around and try to deal with the people we lose that stick it to us. Now I got to worry about the people that are keeping us healthy leaving. So I just got to plead with you that you've got one hand behind my back. I don't mind. We still will compete. I'm happy to move uphill and go uphill all the time. But at this point, with both hands behind my back, I don't know where to turn, Madam Chair.
Okay, Mr. Brinkman, I think at least am understanding, you know, that this is pretty serious stuff. And I think I know, Senator Dahl, I want the members to see that report, and I also want, and Mr. Brinkman said he'll share with us the response.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I will say, Mr. Brinkman and Mr. Straczynski, speaking for some members who may have a concern about the kinds of things that are being funded with premium dollars, you know, that's kind of sticky as far as I'm concerned. You know, if it's being paid in premium for health care coverage, then that's what it should go to. And it looks like the current law provides for an ability to assess each district. And, I mean, that could be done by members, individuals in that pool, in that school district or county unit or whatever governmental unit it is. Because this would affect, obviously, all the service co-ops, not just those for schools, but cities, counties, and other kinds of entities. I think nursing homes and, it seems to me, other kind of entities can be part of the pool. So I think, Senator Dahl, I'm going to let Senator Clark present her bill. I think we'll lay this over. We'll come back to it. But I do want members to see the report and the response, if you will.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you,
okay.
Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay. We do have an explanation for all of that. And keep in mind we're pulling New Jersey.
So we're going to get a copy, at least of the executive summary, I think probably would satisfy most members. If anybody wants the full report, they can have that.
But, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Dahl, is that?
Yep. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. So that's laid over. We'll come back to it, not today, but we're going to give the members a chance to see that information. And Senator Clark.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members.
Good afternoon. And you have before us Senate File 489. And I kind of assume, assuming we'll take, you know, pretty much this hour. I know Senator Prettner-Solon has a committee meeting at 3 that she chairs, and most of us have to go to one.
That's fine, Madam Chair. I know the Chamber of Commerce thinks I'm coming and doing a panel somewhere around then, too. So. But this is, of course, more important. So, not to say they're not.
Yes. So, this has to do with reverse mortgages.
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, yes, I know sometimes my voice is softer than my children would say it is. If it's okay with you, Madam Chair, I'll explain a little bit about what we're attempting to do here, and then I have Carla Heil from the Attorney General's office. This is an Attorney General's proposal. We've been working together with them, with AARP, with Lutheran Social Services and others, and we've got a couple other people to testify as well.
Okay, and there are some people who have concerns who will also be testifying, yes. So, and the bill isn't terribly long, and I think you can, I don't know, are you going to go through that, or are you going to have Ms. Heil do that?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll probably note a couple of the things, okay. And then I'll have Ms. Heil go through that, if that's all right. Members, just for in case, for those of you who may not be aware, reverse mortgages are sold and marketed to senior citizens, usually 62 years of age and above. They can be very appropriate in some situations, and our bill today does nothing to prohibit their availability because we do think that is important. Under a reverse mortgage, the company pays the senior citizen a lump sum or periodic payments using the equity in the senior's home. The senior typically does not need to repay the loan until he or she dies or moves. Usually in the reverse order of that, Senator Vandeveer, I could tell you were thinking about that. Reverse mortgages, again, may be suitable for some seniors based on their financial circumstances. They are not suitable for others. There has recently become some troubling marketing practices. And in particular with this bill, one of the things that we're trying to make sure is that we're being proactive, that we learned the lessons from some of the subprime loans and some of the issues that happened with predatory lending. There are plenty of good brokers out there that are doing reverse mortgages, but there are starting to see some troubling practices with how these are marketed. And I will say for myself, before I go too much further, a couple of the reasons why I was particularly interested in this is I used to do legal practice with the Senior Law Project, worked with a number of seniors in a variety of situations. Sometimes people who were trying to figure out what to do with their assets, as one of the spouses was needing to go into a nursing home and trying to figure that out. Other times it was about Medicaid and Medicare. A lot of times, frankly, it was a question bringing in the Medicare Part B statements and saying, what do I need to do with this, even though it clearly said this is not a bill on it. So I know firsthand that sometimes opportunities and maybe inappropriate opportunities can be a real challenge for somebody to figure out. And as we become a much more mobile group of people, their children may not be near them to help them kind of sift through all of this. And frankly, one should not need an attorney to figure out whether or not a reverse mortgage is a good idea. The other reason why I was particularly interested in this is my parents are realtors. They're both real estate brokers. My dad is retired from that now. My mother still does some. And she was approached about 6 months ago from a company soliciting her, since the housing market was drying up, to become a broker of this. And she seriously thought about it. And then she called me back and said, you know nothing about these kind of products. And most of who my clients are right now are people I've known for a long time, and they trust me. If I'm going out selling this to them, how do I know this is the best thing for them? And When the Attorney General came to me and I started looking into this more, what we've seen is a starting troubling trend among some. Reverse mortgages, as I said, are not suitable for all seniors and may be an expensive way of obtaining financing. Some troublesome aspects of some of the marketing tactics may include marketing a reverse mortgage to a senior that bears a higher fees and costs is less suitable than other available financing options. Using easy credit marketing tactics similar to those that led to the mortgage meltdown by encouraging a senior to take out an expensive reverse mortgage to finance a lifestyle they would otherwise be unable to afford while ignoring the risky aspects of those products, which may consume the senior's home equity. Lastly, using high-pressure cross-selling tactics where the seller or an affiliate encourages a senior to take out a reverse mortgage only to put the proceeds in a long-term care insurance policy or a long-term deferred annuity where the cost of the mortgage outweighs any investment gains on the new investment. Now, the FBI has recently seen a spike in reverse mortgage fraud, both with regard to excessive fees and abusive marketing practices. Although some government-guaranteed reverse mortgages are regulated and insured by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, many are not, leaving seniors without protections and standards afforded in the federal law. In 2007, the legislature passed legislation to eliminate many predatory lending practices as it related to mortgages. Many of these practices led to national mortgage foreclosure, meltdown, and subsequent market turmoil. Seniors' home equity may appear to be an attractive market niche to lenders, agents, and brokers looking for a new market. Again, what we're trying to do is prevent that from occurring. So to that end, the Reverse Mortgage Marketing Reform Act would require lenders to determine that a given reverse mortgage is suitable for the senior before selling it to them, limit insurance producers from cross-selling annuities, life insurance, or long-term care insurance products to a senior using the proceeds of a reverse mortgage. And I want to add here that the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council supports this portion of the bill because they want to make sure that it's not appropriate to use the proceeds for those types of products. And providing a 30-day rescission period in which a senior may rescind a reverse mortgage. And lastly, aligning Minnesota law with federal reverse mortgage lending requirements. And, Madam Chair, I think now it might make some sense to turn it over to Ms. Heil.
Ms. Heil, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Carla Heil, Assistant Attorney General. As Senator Clark said, the reason that we have concern with reverse mortgages is because they are marketed often as financial planning tools to senior citizens. And looking at the market today, there is approximately $4 trillion that seniors have in their homes. And it is estimated that in 20 years, there will be $37 trillion in seniors' homes. And over 80% of senior citizens own their home. The National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association has said that they can foresee 1 million reverse mortgages done a year. Last year, there was only 100,000 reverse mortgages done. So you can see the concern about this being a growing trend. And we want to, as Senator Clark said, get out in front of any problem that we saw in predatory lending and be preventive and proactive. As Senator Clark said, in October of 2008, four federally insured reverse mortgages, the federal government did tighten some conditions. And what we want to do with this bill is impose those conditions on all reverse mortgages sold to senior citizens in the state of Minnesota, not just federally insured reverse mortgages, but privatized or proprietary reverse mortgages. One of those aspects is requiring that a senior borrower, go to a HUD-approved counselor, and that is in Section 3 of this bill. And we have people here today who will describe that their sessions regularly take 1 hour, that they discuss far more than just reverse mortgages, because although reverse mortgages are appropriate for some consumers, there's other social service concerns and other home loan concerns or options that would also be discussed. But there's still federal guidelines that are going to be implemented on counseling, and we want this to be available or required for all reverse mortgages sold to seniors in the state of Minnesota. Additionally, under the federal regulation that was passed in October, there's also a provision that will have a firewall to prevent cross-selling or to limit cross-selling of annuities and life insurances from reverse mortgages. However, that also, the guidelines are not in effect on that. We want to have, again, that aspect apply to all reverse mortgages in Minnesota, plus we also want to make it tighter, that the language is more than just a firewall. It's more than just marketing annuities and life insurance after a rescission period. Instead, annuities, life insurances, long-term insurance is not appropriate product for the from the proceeds of reverse mortgages. And the cross-selling provision is in Section 9 of this bill. One of the other aspects that this bill provides is that the lender needs to determine the suitability of the reverse mortgage for the senior citizen. And suitability is a common concept in Minnesota. We require suitability determinations for insurance. We require suitability determinations for securities. That's also what we're looking at in this language in Section 7 of the bill, that the lender has to determine the suitability of a reverse mortgage for a senior citizen who is looking to take out a reverse mortgage. Now, certainly there is counseling advising the senior citizen of other options and how a reverse mortgage would affect the financial aspects, but counseling does not take the place of responsible lending. And where insurance and securities look to suitability, that is what we would want for reverse mortgages, that lenders also look for suitability, since this, again, is being marketed as a financial planning option for seniors.
That noise is from somebody's cell phone that's on, if you want to check your cell phones.
Madam Chair, it's not me.
Okay.
The other main aspect of the bill, as Senator Clark has said, is that there is a rescission period of 30 days. And under the there is presently a three-day rescission period. However, that is very short, far too short to consider a reverse mortgage. For most Americans, a home is their largest equity. It is their largest asset. And to have a reverse mortgage 3 days, and knowing that Saturday counts as one of those days, is hardly enough time to consider what the consequences of that. And that's why we are looking for a 30-day rescission period. Now, certainly industry lenders might say the rescission period and suitability will make reverse mortgages unavailable to seniors in the state of Minnesota. However, we heard that 2 years ago when we had legislation to try to limit predatory lending. And if a reverse mortgage is suitable today, it will be suitable after a rescission period. And that's what we want to have, our suitable reverse mortgages available to our senior citizens, and to cut down and find ways to eliminate the abuse that can occur with reverse mortgages, as the FBI has pointed out and as other organizations have referenced. I have one other item to discuss, and this is from AARP, and I do think we have somebody here to testify also. But one of the aspects of a reverse mortgage that is a concern, as Senator Clark said, is taking out a reverse mortgage and buying an annuity or a life insurance. And one of the concerns is the high cost of reverse mortgages and spending that money to get an annuity. And what I have is from an AARP book, which you can find on the internet, and it talks about the costs of a reverse mortgage. And I just want to give an example straight from AARP's book. It's if a senior citizen who's 75 years old and his house is worth $250,000, he would be eligible for a $135,000 reverse mortgage, according to this AARP pamphlet. And in this example, if he took out a $67,000 reverse mortgage, got that up front, the upfront cost would be $12,000. But they also have total monthly insurance payments that would go forward. And in this example, it's a 12-year provision. And so that would be almost $8,000. And then there's monthly servicing fees, which would come to $5,000. And so the cost of servicing a $67,000 reverse mortgage under this example is $25,000. And then you have the monthly interest charges of $111,000. And again, this is for 12 years. So the person's house is $250,000. They took out a $67,000 reverse mortgage up front. And then when they have to pay it back, say they move into an assisted living facility, they now have to pay back $203,000. So the remaining equity is only $47,000. And that's the concern.
Okay. I think members got that point. Okay. Senator Clark?
Madam Chair, we have a couple of people who'd like to go ahead and testify.
Yes.
Would you like to have them now? I know that Mr. Dahlheimer is going to have to actually leave pretty quickly, so if we could have,
absolutely.
Have him.
Mr. Dahlheimer, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Daryl Dahlheimer. I'm the Program Director at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota for the Financial Counseling Services. Our service line provides financial counseling and housing counseling, which includes being a foreclosure prevention provider and a reverse mortgage counseling provider, as certified by both HUD and Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. So, i.e., this is our bread and butter to understand how reverse mortgages interact with seniors, and we sit firmly in the middle of the industry, I believe, which is to say they are a wonderful product that allows seniors to not be house rich and cash poor in their later years. However, like many other mortgage products, there is a side to them that can be creatively financed and being snookered right out of your house. So we're here to kind of speak to the balance that this would provide by having this legislation. We support this legislation as a safeguard to protect Minnesota seniors from predatory features of an otherwise good product. I'd like to offer a very brief snapshot based on actual experience of three of our clients, and I deliberately chose three typical stories as opposed to inflammatory stories for the committee to hear, because I think this will give you an idea of how what happens in the actual playing out of the industry currently. First client is a couple in their senior years who told us that their financial planner had referred them to get a reverse mortgage, referred to the lender by their financial planner for the purpose of taking out a lump sum and investing the proceeds in the stock market with this financial planner. I hope I hear the gasps for that. The reverse mortgage counseling was helpful to them. We don't tell people what to do. You know, that's part of the prohibition, is there's no advice given, but there is full disclosure of all the options, advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives as required by HUD. The reverse mortgage counselor helped them understand that the interest charges accrue rapidly on the reverse mortgage taken, and that any investment, of course, would have to make at least that much back to even break even, and that there's no guarantees in the investment world.
Mr. Dahlheimer, did they come to you before they signed up? Or
Madam Chair, the requirement federally is that no one may have a reverse mortgage until they receive a certificate of reverse mortgage counseling at a HUD-approved lender. And what's brilliant about this legislation is currently everyone who goes for a HECM mortgage, which is a particular product, HECM, home equity conversion mortgage, everyone in the country is safe in that way. But all these additional new reverse mortgage products do not require this counseling nor the certificate.
And Senator Clark appreciates having brilliant legislation.
Yes.
So. It could happen momentarily.
I saw her smile.
Maybe within a half an hour once.
You could do Dahlheimer. It. Sorry. Second story, just to give you another example of how this plays out. A second senior homeowner was referred to a lender by a friend and asked appropriate questions of that lender but was told inappropriate information. The senior was savvy enough to ask, if I take out a credit line, surely I'm paying interest on that credit line, and was told by the lender, no, actually, we pay you interest on this credit line. Patently false information, probably an oversight on the part of the lender, but I don't know. The third client was someone who was actually brought to the reverse mortgage counseling by an insurance agent who had befriended this senior, who was otherwise fairly isolated but full of home equity, and it encouraged her to take out a reverse mortgage specifically to use the lump sum to buy a deferred annuity product from that agent for a commission. So what we're hearing as themes of the stories we see are that seniors are desperately in need of reverse mortgage counseling as a check and balance, just as an appropriate marketplace check and balance for the hard sell and inappropriate cross sell of many products that go along next door to reverse mortgage products. And secondly, that these three seniors were actually pretty lucky because they had applied to get a HECM loan as opposed to the other products that are out there. Everyone else is left completely on their own in the marketplace. However, this regulation and this legislation as proposed means that we have an opportunity to protect all of Minnesota seniors, not just certain products. And the metaphor that Senator Clark mentioned, I will say, is completely accurate. In the subprime lending industry, we saw that people were safe, for the most part, with VA and FHA-backed mortgage loans, all of the ones that many of our parents had and many of us have had. However, with the growth of conventional non-conforming loans, i.e. creative loans, liar loans, predatory loans in the media, with the growth of those, people were no longer safe because these products were not easily understood. And frankly, many of them are being schnookered out of their houses right now. You have the chance to prevent this from happening by providing a uniform standard of reverse mortgage counseling for all products. You're going to hear the industry say, I'm confident, that this will put them out of business to have any kind of onerous regulation. I want to say that it certainly did not put HECM lenders out of business. They've been in business and growing and growing and growing in the numbers they serve. And furthermore, I'd say, in fairness, we see many financial service industries that we intersect with in consumer credit counseling. Housing lenders, payday lenders, legitimate banks and credit unions. And like many industries, in the lending industry, there's good and bad apples. And all this legislation does is allow bad apples to be regulated. We believe that good apples should welcome the oversight of this regulation and the provision of reverse mortgage counseling. As the Supreme Court Justice most famously said, sunshine is the best disinfectant in this area. Thank you.
Mr. Dahlheimer, thank you. And members, I wanted to note that we had received an email earlier this morning from Robin Rowan from the, I'm not sure what their acronym stands for, but it's Financial Services, and you know they represent life insurance companies, and they do support this piece of the bill that has to do with using reverse mortgage. You know, they agree with where the bill is on that, using that to buy annuities or other, you know, long-term care or whatever other policies be done.
And Madam Chair, their name is the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, and
I can
almost get that out of my mouth.
Thank you.
I don't know if, Madam Chair, I don't know if you or any of the members might have questions for Mr. Dahlheimer before he goes. I know normally you wait a little bit longer, but I know he's going to have to leave.
Any questions? Senator Olson, quickly, because we want to get her out of here in 37 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this is going to be addressed, but the one question I have about something that I think is a great bill and is important that everyone has counseling, but what I wonder how it will work is when you're determining what you charge, and I'm assuming we can't just totally regulate these things because of federal law preemption, if I'm not sure if that's right, where we could just say, you know, you can't charge excessive interest rates or you're limited to charging this much. I don't know if we could do that or not. But what I wonder about is the part that says that the loan will not be due until the person leaves their house, that change, until they either die or it's
so that may not. You think this is for Mr. Dahlheimer?
Well, maybe not. I was just wondering how that would be figured in calculating interest, since it could be so variable. That was my question.
Mr. Dahlheimer, do you want to respond?
Madam Chair, Senator, actually, I am not a reverse mortgage expert personally for this. But however, that's part of, I can add some light, that part of reverse mortgage counseling is to use software that's HUD-approved software for calculating variety of scenarios. So if it was at this interest rate, this is what your payout would be, your down payment, your costs would be. If it was at this one, and it not only is it a requirement to talk about the scenarios that might happen, but also to compare several products side by side so that seniors are well informed about their alternatives.
Okay.
Does that answer that?
No, not quite, but maybe Ms. Heil, but I don't think that the question is for you.
I
think it maybe Ms. Heil. Maybe Mr. Dahlheimer, thank you
very much.
Do you understand the question, the stricken language on page 1, line 19, right?
Right.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, I mean, I guess what I would like to see is that we have as much regulation as we're allowed to have under, you know, as the federal law allows us to have, to not make the interest rates and charges onerous on, you know, toward people, that we have some limitation on what can be charged in interest. But if we can't do that and we have this language stricken here, it seems like there's not going to be any way to calculate. You know, you don't know if someone's going to stay in their house another year or another 20 or 30 years. And how would you calculate the rate to know what to charge somebody when you have that unknown variable? And does that mean that some people would end up paying more because now there's going to be this, that the lenders have to take into consideration something that you know, usually when you're calculating the interest or a loan charge, you have to put in all these finite numbers, and you can't have something that's an unknown variable. And how are you going to get the best deal if you have that unknown variable? That's my question.
Senator Olson, I wondered, too, what it means when the committed principal amount has been fully paid. In other words, when the lender, the person who issued the reverse mortgage, has made all the payments. Today, current law says that that's then due when that happens. And this bill says it isn't due when that happens. It isn't due until this property is sold. So, in other words, once the payments have all been made, it looks like the person who may still be living there now doesn't owe until the property is sold, and that could be after they die. Yes, Ms. Heil.
Madam Chairman, I believe if you look at if Senator Olson is looking at Section 1, where we have one part deleted, but on Section 2, you have actually the four parts: upon the sale, the death of the late, the last survivor. Those are the standard times when a reverse mortgage is actually due. A reverse mortgage is a non-recourse loan, meaning it's only the house that is the is against the loan. And the reverse mortgage, one of the benefits is that it's upon the sale of the property, if they move to some other facility, if the last person dies, and that and if it's no longer their principal, or upon renegotiating the terms of the reverse mortgage where they have that agreement. Those are the four provisions that are also in federal law. And in response to, I think, the question about the interest rate, there is, as the previous person said, there is a HUD-sponsored package, and that is, it is determined upon the life expectancy. If you're 75, your life expectancy is so many years. So there is various options of interest rates, and that is defined, which doesn't answer your question by the look.
Okay. We want to give some thought to that. But Senator Clark, do you have anybody else?
I think we don't have that answer quite.
Ms. Stone? Good afternoon, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate File 489. Legislation was
I need you just to say your name and who you're representing for us.
I was going to do that in the next sentence.
I'm sorry.
I am Christine Stone, a volunteer with AARP in the grassroots election and advocacy team. AARP would like to thank Senator Clark, our partisan co-authors, and Attorney General Swanson for their leadership in bringing this legislation forward. Older Americans have been among the hardest hit by this economic crisis. Many have lost retirement savings and employment while struggling to pay the increasing cost of living. For most older Minnesotans, our home constitutes the biggest and the most important part of our saving. In fact, two-thirds of the Americans age 65 and older own their homes free and clear. In today's economic downturn, older homeowners across the state are increasingly turning to reverse mortgage to pay life's necessities, such as needed home repairs, health care, and long-term care. ARP believes that, in general, reverse mortgage should be used as a last resort for most consumers. We know that reverse mortgages can be a useful safety net for many Minnesotans who have no other choice and they want to remain independently living. I would like to call your attention to several areas of the bill that we believe will have a positive protective impact on consumers. We support the suitability clause intended to ensure that reverse mortgages are sold only to people who need them. Lenders should be held responsible for selling loans that they know are bad to particular consumers. We also support the prohibition of cross-selling. Too often, the home equity borrower is depleted because they are offered inappropriate financial products, such as annuities or long-term care insurance. Consumers should be wary of anyone who tries to sell them something to be paid for with a reverse mortgage. If anyone is trying to sell you something and recommending you use a reverse mortgage to pay for it, that's generally a good sign that you don't need it and shouldn't be buying it. We also support the mandatory counseling provision of the bill. At this point, I'd like to say I was AARP's advocate back in the early 90s when we passed that counseling for seniors along with Senior Federation and the other senior organizations, and are pleased that the time frame in which consumers can reconsider their loan is expanded. We're also pleased that the bill increases the responsibility of lenders so that the originator and the buyer of the loan can both be held responsible for any unscrupulous action by the loan organizer. We believe this bill will help protect those homeowners who may be considering a reverse mortgage to meet their needs and ensure that they get a fair product that best meets their needs. We look forward to working with you to see this important legislation passed. Thank you.
Stone, thank you very much. Are there any questions? Senator Sparks.
Thank you, and I think Ms. Stone brings up a good point. And actually, I'm not going to ask you your question, but thank you for your testimony. Maybe Ms. Heil can help me. In Section 7 relating to the suitability clause, beginning on line 615, the suitability of a recommended purchase of a reverse mortgage loan will be determined by reference to the totality of the particular borrower's circumstances, including to but not limited to. Now, I understand the borrower's income, age, assets, need for a reverse mortgage, and obviously as lenders they look at debt-to-income ratios and other things. But continuing on, can you kind of help clarify, or how would we define and the values, benefits, and costs of the recommended reverse mortgage loans when compared to the values, benefits, and costs of other loans? I'm just having a little trouble understanding how we quantify or how values, benefits, and costs would be.
Ms. Heil.
Madam Chairman, I believe that with reverse mortgages, compare that to home equity loans might be a different option. And there are also other options that a senior citizen might have available to pay for. I think sometimes they get these loans to make their house more accessible, and there would be other options. What's the value of that? What's the benefit? What's the cost also?
So I think, Senator Sparks, I think that we do, I don't know if it was Senator Higgins' legislation several years ago that talked about predatory lending, and we said, because we had people who were being put into subprime mortgages who qualified for prime mortgages, and they did not, but they were being sold products that were more expensive and something they could have qualified for better terms. And I think we did something along those lines.
Madam Chair, that's, I think, I'm not totally opposed to what Senator Clark's trying to do. I just didn't know if counsel or maybe the AG's office had something, but I don't know how you really determine a value that I might have might be different than Senator Metzen or Senator Marty. And that's what I'm just trying to decide, how a lender is supposed to decide
those values
and benefits. So maybe that's something I ought to look at moving forward.
Senator Clark or Ms. Heil.
I think there might be, Madam Chairman, the values, benefits, and cost, it's like net, as opposed to if you're thinking of an ideological value, I think it's more the ultimate, what you get out of it, that type of value, a numerical value, the benefits and the costs.
And Madam Chair, I think, again, it's too bad Mr. Dahlheimer had to leave, because I think that what you find is that the HUD software, among others, helps with identifying that. And, you know, in addition, Madam Chair, to what we did with regard to predatory lending and suitability, too, there are similar suitability clauses both for selling a security or an insurance product. So this is something that you and I both thought we'd seen it in other places. Right. We went looking, and it's not something that's an unfamiliar term.
Senator Vandeveer, did you have your?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I don't know who would answer this, but I get a kick out of the right of rescission part. It says the borrower may rescind any reverse mortgage within 30 days of execution by providing written notice to the lender. And it goes on to say, a notice of rescission given by the borrower need not take a particular form and is sufficient if it indicates by any form of written expression, color crayons, I don't know, the intention of the borrower not to be bound by the reverse mortgage transaction. These cost quite a bit to record. Are they not then supposed to be recorded for 30 days? And it doesn't, maybe I'm missing it here, but I don't see where it says anything about the cost of getting the mortgage. Does the lender just eat that, or other people that get a reverse mortgage, I suppose, will eat that? But
it's how I thought I saw language that had to do with some things being
I believe
returned.
That it also says it must be returned, Madam Chair. it's, I believe, the next line, it does talk about any payment received in connection with the reverse mortgage must be returned within 15 days of the rescission, if that answers your question.
So that would be 45 days after they close the loan, they get that money. And it doesn't say anything about the cost of the mortgage. Who pays for all that?
Ms. Isle, you mean the cost of preparing the mortgage document?
Well, you have the application, the origination, the credit check, the appraisal, the all of that. You know, every mortgage has them. Have you ever got one?
Madam Chair, I believe that quite often the costs are put up front. And so if they receive that or that was taken out, I believe that would be part of the amount that would have to be paid back.
Doesn't say that, though.
Right. It
so I mean, there could have been an appraisal. There would have been credit check, those kinds of things. That's what Senator Vandeveer is asking about here. Are those costs that then get returned to the borrower, the homeowner?
You're correct. It does not actually cover who actually pays for it, because in some situations it would come out of the borrower would pay those costs up front.
But Ms. Heil, did you say then that you're assuming that those things would then be repaid? Because the service would have been performed. I mean, there would have been an appraisal. There would have been a credit check.
And, Madam Chair, what about the state deed tax?
We're talking about
a lot of money here, actually.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's really fair here. I think you're onto something. If I do this and I get cold feet, and somebody's going to be out $3,000-$4,000 for the points and for the recording fees and the stamps and what have you, I'm the one that backs out. Who pays the $3,000 or $4,000? Mm-hmm. In the lending institution, and I guess not here defending them, but I mean, if they had the appraisal for $650 and everything else, it's not my fault. Then I say, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. Who gets stuck for the three? You know, if I'm the banker and I did all of this, and most of it because they sell the things too, it's not my money. It's, you know, that's, you understand what I'm saying?
Do you anticipate what would happen in that 30 days? And I don't know if the number 30 is magic. If something less would be better or not, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe Senator Olson can contribute here.
Well, Madam Chair, what I'm just wondering, I mean, I agree. I think there's a valid point that's been raised that it's not fair that someone would be stuck with costs because someone else changed their mind. But on the other hand, there might be a lot of these costs that are a lot higher than they would need to be because something doesn't. Most of those costs are going to come at the time. The origination fee or whatever, if the loan's going to be resold, I guess I don't have a problem with the lender losing that, because if they really don't, if someone's been pressured into a loan that they really wasn't suitable for them, then maybe they shouldn't be making money on that. But those costs are not going to be able to recoup, like the recording fees and the taxes that would have to be paid. I mean, maybe it's more fair to make it a 15-day window and say you're not going to record the mortgage for 15 days or something, because if you had a period of time when you didn't record this and you held it, you wouldn't have to have all those fees.
No, Senator Olson, I certainly think you wouldn't. You'd probably want to.
But at that point, you've already gone through the counseling and you've already been educated. So now it's my fault because, like, you had your counseling or whoever fault, whoever put out the money. And what are we supposed to do? I mean,
I think, Madam Chair, it's another day in the neighborhood. We're just putting more people out of work and more people out of business. And we don't really know what we're doing, but we feel good about it.
I take some exception, but,
Madam Chair,
I think we're giving this some thoughtful consideration here. And I think you raised a really, good question.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Clark.
I personally believe that's something that's omitted here, and that what we might do, maybe Mr. Stang can help us with, is that we could have some language in here that refers to the type of cost that would have been done, the origination fee, the the appraisal, and that if somebody didn't pay it up front, that that is subtracted from the money.
I think there's procedures
that would go back to them. And remember, we do have a rescission time period on the federal standpoint.
And Senator Clark, I was going to ask, Mr. Stang asked me, what do we do today with the 3-day? I'm assuming that there's nothing's recorded, obviously, in those 3 days. But if the borrower rescinds within the 3-day limit, I don't know. We have some folks who are familiar with banking. Senator Sparks, I don't know if you know what happens today if somebody says we've changed our mind.
3-day. On the 3-day right of rescission, but you'd still have some upfront fees on the, for well, the appraisal.
That you would owe.
Right.
That would not be forgiven, am I correct, Senator
correct.
Sparks?
I think if we put some language in here, we will have dealt with this. You know, the only concern I have with that, and I think that that's something we should do, is that we do have some situations where, to use Mr. Dahlheimer's word, where people are getting snookered, they're basically going to be out of some costs because somebody was convincing them. So my hope is that with the counseling, et cetera, that maybe we're giving enough pause in there. But it's certainly, we don't want people to be stuck with out-of-pocket costs as they're doing this. So I would think we should be able to go ahead and probably pretty quickly come up with the right language for that.
Yeah, Senator Clark, I think we're trying to balance.
Oh, yes.
We don't want the senior to be taken advantage of, but on the other hand, we don't want lenders hanging out there where, you know, people are.
And Madam Chair, Senator Vanderveer came up with one of the few things that I didn't raise questions about previously. So I'm glad that you caught that. But I think we should be able to go ahead and put language in that would deal with that.
So, Senator Clark, you're thinking of those kind of prepaid, I won't even call them that, but right. Things like appraisals, credit checks, those kinds of costs that are associated with preparing mortgage documents for the closing.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vanderveer.
I think a 45-day rescission or 45-day timeline is very complicated, and I don't know that I would recommend that you table the bill or lay it over until it's finished, because I don't think I think just throwing language in here at this point is risky also.
Well, Senator Vanderveer, I'm going to suggest that we try to have Mr. Stang come up with some kind of language here to do what Senator Clark is agreeing. You've made a good point. I'd like to give the people who are opposed to this an opportunity to speak, and maybe, I don't know if you want to go.
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure what I've been asked to do at this point.
It's
Madam Chair, can I make a suggestion?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'm just thinking that on line 6.2, after the word lender, that that would be the place that some language would belong, where the person has to return the payments. And that probably you'd want language in there after lender, something like less any costs incurred by the lender in relation to making the loan or something like that, you know, just as a suggestion. But I don't think it
place.
Has to be very
Although,
complicated.
Yeah, and that's only, of course, if you've received any payment, and maybe you haven't. I'm not sure I'd be sending out payments yet. I'd like to hear from some people in the industry to know what that might do in terms of that payment. But that's a thought. But Stang, if you can look at that, you know what we're saying, that those costs that have been incurred on the part of the lender were, I think I'm hearing the committee suggesting that it's not fair for the lender then to bear that risk.
I will try.
Okay.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Clark.
The author agrees with that. That would not be a fair thing.
So I have Mr. Bell and Ms. Patterson, if you would come up. Good afternoon and welcome. Which one of you wishes to go first?
May
Mr.
I please?
Bell?
Yes.
Absolutely.
So. Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to join you here this afternoon. My name is Peter Bell, and I'm the president of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association out of Washington, D.C. We are a national trade association that represents the reverse mortgage lending industry, and our 600 member companies represent about 90% of the business that gets done in reverse mortgages nationally. By way of my own background, I am an affordable housing policy analyst and advocate that has been active in this area in Washington for 32 years. And about 12 years ago, the reverse mortgage industry came to me to ask my thoughts on what they might be able to do to build stronger consumer confidence in the reverse mortgage concept. And our association is an outgrowth of those discussions. So making consumers educated, aware, and comfortable with reverse mortgages and helping policymakers to understand the implications of reverse mortgages are really the foundation of our association. We very much at NIRMLA support what you are trying to do here to make sure that reverse mortgages have protections that are meaningful and effective. We also, of course, want to make sure that they don't get in the way of making reverse mortgages available to Minnesota homeowners. This bill, as I interpret it, basically looks to take protections that are essentially already existing in the Federal Housing Administration HECM program and attempts to strengthen them and, more importantly, to apply them to proprietary products. I should point out, by the way, that at the moment there are no proprietary products in this country. The HECM is the sole source of reverse mortgages right now. There was a fledgling proprietary market before the credit implosion about 2 years ago, and now all those markets, all those products have been withdrawn from the marketplace. We think the idea of taking the federal protections, applying them to proprietary products, is a very good idea. We support this wholeheartedly, and particularly with regard to counseling, but also with regard to a number of the other areas. Counseling in our organization is the most important safeguard there is for making sure that prospective borrowers fully understand reverse mortgages and helping them assess whether or not a reverse mortgage might be an appropriate solution in their particular situation. Extending counseling to proprietary loans is something that we advocate. In fact, we require it. Even where it's not required by law, we require all of our members to do counseling on every reverse mortgage loan they have. When we had proprietary products, every product in the country that was available over the past few years when they were available did have a counseling component to it, and that was largely a result of our best practices and our insistence in our organization. In fact, one major name brand bank that everyone is aware of tried to enter the market and say that they thought they had a better solution than counseling, and we told them that's fine, but they're not welcome to be members of our association, and turned them away. Eventually, they came around and implemented counseling and joined our organization. I think it's important that everybody understand the whole counseling process, and the gentleman from Lutheran Social Services spoke earlier, gave a little bit of a sense of it, but I think it's really important to fully understand it, since this is such an important safeguard, if not the most important safeguard. We, by law, under the HECM program and by industry best practice and all other products, require every single borrower to go out and meet with an independent third-party counselor employed at a nonprofit counseling organization that's been approved by HUD and for the most part trained by AARP before we're allowed to take a loan application from them, before we could subject them to any cost or fees whatsoever. So the process does not begin until the prospective borrower has gone out, met with the counselor, gone through the counseling session. The counselor then issues a counseling certificate, which the counselor signs, provides that to the prospective borrower, and then the prospective borrower has to make the conscious decision to sign that him or herself, and then pass that along to the lender. And that's when the process begins. So there is nothing that can go on other than very preliminary information. A lender could take a look at what is the approximate value of the house. They could teach the prospective client about it, but they cannot do any processing. They cannot collect any fees until after that counseling certificate is in hand. Very, very important. The counseling itself is done in accordance with two documents, the federal statute, which has about three or four things in general level that are supposed to go on, and a HECM counseling protocol that was put together by a group of stakeholders that included HUD, of course, AARP, National Council on Aging, and our organization. The statute basically says that the counseling session is supposed to make sure that the senior understands the transaction that they're contemplating, in other words, the structure and mechanics of it, that they understand the impact it will have on their estate, the fact that they're spending down the value in the house and it will not be there to be passed on to heirs or should they need it once they sell the house. It's supposed to take a look at any alternatives that might be available for them. An example would be we often find seniors looking at this as a means of paying their real property taxes, but very often the jurisdiction they live in might have a tax deferral program that better suits their needs. Or another instance might be they need an emergency home repair, and there's an emergency home repair grant program that's available. So the counseling looks at all of these alternatives, and the counseling is conducted in accordance with the counseling protocol that I mentioned. So we, once again, just to conclude on this section, we wholeheartedly endorse counseling. We believe it should be by law required by on products where it's not required under the federal statute. And even if you don't do it, we will continue to do it, at least for our members, under best practices.
So, Mr. Bell, it sounds like you don't really agree with so much the substance, just that the state of Minnesota would be saying. I mean, if you're talking about the counseling and how it works and the suitability is addressed in the counseling,
yes,
and our saying that it must be, doesn't sound like that would be problematic.
No, counseling is not problematic whatsoever.
Well, Mr. Bell, I mean the suitability requirement.
Yes, I was going to get to suitability, and I'll jump right to that one. Okay, suitability itself, the word, as all of you have seen, when you say it in front of lenders, you could just see them cringe. But let's get beyond that and talk about it. We believe very strongly that no reverse mortgage should be made that is inappropriate for the homeowner and their particular circumstances. Let me repeat that. No reverse mortgage should ever be made that is inappropriate for the homeowner and their particular circumstances. But here's where we run into problems. The situations aren't a matter of black and white. They're shades of gray. When you discuss suitability, there's basically five areas in reverse mortgages that come up. And they are, will the borrower be able to remain in that house and maintain that loan even with a reverse mortgage, maintain that home even with a reverse mortgage? In other words, if we give them a reverse mortgage now and we help them through their current financial situation, will they be able to sustain themselves in their home, or down the road are they going to run into financial problems anyway and lose that home? So that's one. Okay. Two, does the borrower comprehend the transaction? Do they really have the capacity to understand it, the intellectual capacity, the cognitive capacity? Number three, does the borrower plan a long enough duration in the house? Are they planning to stay in the house long enough for it to make sense with the fees they're going to pay for the reverse mortgage? Number four, is there a non-borrower occupant? Does somebody have a spouse who's living with them who's not on title, or another dependent, a child who lives with them who's not on title? Because when the borrower leaves that house and the borrower passes away, that non-borrower occupant will be forced to either pay off the loan or leave. So that is an important one. And the last one is the loan funding an inappropriate cross sale? Those are the five things that come up consistently that are perhaps questions of suitability. All of these types of issues should be addressed in the counseling process if the counseling is working, and there's no clear answer. The mother that has a daughter living with her, the mother may feel that she needs the house, she needs the money to, in order to keep that daughter in the capacity she wants while they're alive, but she knows full well that the daughter can't continue to live in the house when she goes. So she may decide that I want this reverse mortgage, even though I know when I pass away, my daughter will have to make other arrangements. Does the borrower plan to be in the house long enough to make it make sense? The conventional wisdom is that somebody should be in the house a minimum of 2 years, maybe 3 years, to recover the fees. However, I have seen a number of cases where, to give you one example, the woman was 88 years old and with a terminal illness and was expected, had a life expectancy of inside of 2 years, and her choice was to sell the house and go into a nursing home, or to use the reverse mortgage and get care and live out her last days in the house. So once again, the suitability standard would have said no. I think it's hard for any of us to make that decision for the individual. So suitability, to some extent, already exists through the counseling process, and that's the place to address it. you could strengthen the counseling process. Let me move on to another topic that is not addressed in the bill but was brought up here, and to us it's one of the most important ones for the industry.
And, Mr. Bell, we have 4 minutes, so I need you to hurry.
Okay, we have 4 minutes for me?
No, for what I have to cover?
The committee is done.
Okay. All right, well, let me say that these are complex issues, and this is part of the problem with the process is that the time, I understand your constraints, what you'll have to work with, and I'll be glad to come to Minnesota as many times as necessary and meet with people individually, but there's a lot to discuss here. And I heard a lot of things said that were incorrect. I've heard things said as attributed to my organization, which probably means me, that I never said earlier here. So I think there's a lot of things to straighten out.
Mr. Bell, could you tell me something that was attributed to you?
Yes, National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association said that there'll be 1 million loans a year. There was a comment of that one.
I didn't know that they were the ones who said that. I know
we expect
it to grow. Yeah.
That was the attribution there, and I know the interview where we discussed it. So,
do we expect this is growing? I mean, I assume with the television advertising, let your home take care of you. I mean, I've got to believe it's going to be on the increase.
It will increase, but for one thing, and that's the reason I'm here today.
Yes.
The only impediment to growth of this business is headline risk. Okay, if consumers feel that the products are fair and are offered by upstanding companies, then consumers will use this product. So we have a very strong interest in making sure that every client that gets a reverse mortgage has a very positive experience, that they only get it if it's appropriate for them, and that they are treated with the utmost.
And, of course, I mean, Mr. Bell, I think that Senator Clark has brought this bill forward because we've seen some instances where seniors did not make a fully informed decision or at least have the understanding of their family and the support of their family in doing that and may have not completely understood the ramifications of this, because it's real serious business when it's your largest investment of your lifetime. And I think we saw legislation here 3 and 4 years ago about predatory lending. We were a day late and a dollar short. We came up with counseling on foreclosure. We're a day late and a dollar short, and we're trying not to be that anymore. Senator Clark's trying to get out in front of this issue. Because we still have work to do, for example, on foreclosure and other things. We still haven't solved that problem. So we're trying to head something off at the pass, if you will, in terms of what we see as potential pitfalls. And frankly, if you're saying suitability is an appropriate aspect or term or qualification of this, I'm not sure that I mean, I'm sure you tell your members to sell products that are suitable. I mean, I know you do.
We do. We have a very strong code of ethics and professional responsibility and numerous advisory opinions that back those up. So so we do concur with that. The question is where and how to get the protection in the process for how the process works. The federal government has done a tremendous job with this program. There are so many consumer protections inherent in the HECM program that I don't think that anybody could point to a lot of abuses. There are cross sales, there have been abuses, but they're not reverse mortgage abuses. They're insurance sales abuses. There are laws on the books to deal with those. The issue is enforcing those laws.
Yeah, Mr. Bell, it's probably not the greatest time to tout the federal government's response on financial transactions.
A finer federal government information right now. But
But Mr. Bell, no, I appreciate this. I think Senator Clark has something to say here. We're going to move here. And I know that this is a work in progress. It's going from here to the Judiciary Committee, but I think we can resolve some things that are the concern of this committee. Here.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that where it's going? Yes. Yes. Senator Clark, did you want
to? Yes, Madam Chair, there's a couple of things. I think we've got the language that Mr. Stang's been working on. And, you know, as it relates to suitability, I think it's important for us to remember that every individual selling a security or an insurance product in the state of Minnesota must currently abide by a suitability standard. So we're doing something very similar. I've asked people if they have some other language. Come give me some. Nobody has yet. So my offer still stands. Okay. On the right of rescission, I, too, have been concerned about the length. And so I have an A1 amendment that would reduce that time for 10 business days. And that right now will still allow time for seniors to change their minds or for their children who may know what their level of knowledge or information is to step in to help. But it also happens to be the same length of time that sales of life insurance products have in terms of rescission time frame in Minnesota. And because that they're sold more as a financial planning tool than a loan, and we believe that this time frame is important. And remember, part of what we're trying to get ahead of is those that would not be covered by the federally insured programs.
Senator Scogin, did you say you would move it? Senator Scogin moves the A1 amendment. I think people understand that amendment. And I'm trusting that this is, you know, I think it's being responsive to some of the concern. A lot of us were concerned about the 30 days. Any further discussion on this? All those in favor of the Scogin amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. So we're down to 10 days. And I want to give Ms. Patterson an opportunity to speak. But I wanted us to do that because I think that may help some of the testimony. And I want to tell you, Ms. Patterson, that your letter and the follow-up summary of the issues was distributed to everybody, so we've all had that and had the opportunity to read it, and I've read it. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and I will keep it brief. I'm Beth Patterson with Prestige Mortgage Reverse Mortgages SIDAC. I have specialized in reverse mortgages for 10 years in the state of Minnesota, and through that time I have done the HECM loan as well as proprietary loans. And I have never had a rescission, and all of my loans have been insured by HUD. So I'm very proud of that. I still get calls from my clients, and I've done hundreds of reverse mortgages with clients through the years. I've actually written books to help simplify it, big font, bullet point, easy to read, and even the people that have no finance have complimented me on the books. I, too, care about the seniors, and I'm an advocate for them. I work very closely with senior advocacy organizations, including Adult Protection. And I have story after story on how the reverse mortgage has made a difference in seniors' lives, from helping them to retire, keeping them out of foreclosure, helping them stay in the home, pay their medical expenses. Pardon me? Just giving them that little bit of elbow room. Government agencies are actually talking about reverse mortgages to help them stay in the community, because that saves dollars, government dollars, to help versus going in a nursing home or even assisted living or depending on Medicaid. This bill, and I've talked to lenders, this bill will destroy the reverse mortgage to be done in Minnesota. The 30-day, I've talked to the lenders, 30 days is definitely not.
And Ms. Patterson, we did just change that to 10.
Right, and I'm not sure about the 10 days. I haven't had a chance to talk to them. The documents that the borrowers are given, the process of the reverse mortgages, they go through the counseling, we can start the process. It generally takes 20 to 30 or more days for the process. They have a lot of time to review the information. At the time of application, we are actually required to give them a sample of at least two different reverse mortgage options, a good faith estimate, amortization schedule, total annual loan cost, the important terms, as well as sample closing documents. They can review those as well as take those to their attorney and have time to review it. It is not a fast process. And my concern of this in protecting seniors, I totally am in agreement. My concern is that the lenders will not be able to loan on these restrictions or the guidelines of this. And so they won't be available. Reverse mortgages won't be available in the state.
Ms. Patterson, I don't mean to interrupt you. Is there any evidence right now that this market is shrinking as well as other credit availability for consumers?
I mean, what do you mean by shrinking?
The lack of it. The fact that loans aren't being made. Are you still willing to do these loans? You know, I mean, is there any kind of pulling back on the part of lenders doing this at all?
Not today, because of the way it is. HUD's regulations are in place, and the federal.
Well, I mean, the credit is in tough shape, and HUD's regulations are all there, and it's really hard for people to businesses and individuals to get loans. I just wondered if this market had been had an impact, or is this something that, as Mr. Bell alluded to, but I won't give him attribution for the million of these, but that it is increasing.
The reverse mortgage industry is increasing, and I just, because to be considerate of time, I want to propose a couple other suggestions that will protect the seniors as well as keep the reverse mortgage available. And that would include backtracking a little bit. There are more lenders in the state of Minnesota. Many of them do not do very many. We've had lenders who have done one or two loans in the last year. Those are the ones, they do not understand it. They're giving wrong information, which hurts the seniors and the reverse mortgage industry. So my proposal is to require testing of reverse mortgage originators, testing and licensing, so that anybody who is going to originate a loan in Minnesota does meet the requirements, understand, and have some protocol along with that. And it should be specific to reverse mortgages. I am a mortgage broker. I did have to take the licensing for forward loans. I don't do forward loans. You know, so that wasn't as pertinent to me as having specific licensing.
I think that is really good advice. I mean, I think that it's possible. It's probably the subject of another bill, but I think that we should be sure that in our mortgage broker licensing, we do cover reverse mortgages. So
the test I took had
that.
Total wrong information about reverse mortgages. It just totally blew me away. So they're not providing right information. And along with that is to make the list of originators who have met the criteria, licensing, testing, and licensing required, available to the consumer. Right now, I can tell somebody that I meet the license. I can show them my certificate, but they cannot call the Department of Commerce and say, does Beth Patterson meet these requirements? I think that needs to be a big thing. And additionally, there are lenders across the country who have kind of a call center, and so they may be calling into our Minnesota borrowers, and somebody making the phone call talking to the borrower may not be licensed, but somebody signed the application is. So that's where I think the protection should come in versus doing something that's going to make the lenders walk away and not willing to do reverse mortgages in the state.
Ms. Patterson, as you can see, some of our members have left. One of them had to chair something. I want to say something in the absence of the members that we were 20 minutes late starting, and so we're going over a little bit. I do want to finish this conversation. I don't want to cut you off. I think we understand, and I don't think that those are bad ideas. I think they're good ideas, actually, about licensing, and I think that we may take that into consideration, probably not on this bill.
Right.
Members, I have been discussing with Mr. Stang the language, being concerned about the lender being able to be paid for those out-of-pocket expenses that had to do with appraisal and whatnot. We think that maybe those things are dealt with at the closing. Mr. Stang,
Madam Chair, we could probably put it anyway, but I was just trying to think through the transaction, and I believe all those are deducted at the execution of the documents, so there's nothing for the borrower to repay at that point, because at the closing and execution of the documents, those are already deducted.
That's
what happens now with the 3-day And I think the lender basically holds the documents before they file mortgages and so forth. And I assume they probably hold these documents for the 10 business days before they file as well. But I think these are already netted out before this money is given. So, I don't think there's a real need for it, but, you know, if there's – I've got comfort language if
– Right. I think we're going to want that. I'm not sure.
That's fine.
And it can be worked on and handled in judiciary, just as long as members in this committee know where we're headed with that. Senator Clark.
And, Madam Chair, I was just wondering, and I obviously am committed to making sure we do that when we get to judiciary if we can't figure this out very quickly, but perhaps then the language that needs to be in there, perhaps only for comfort, is – assuring that if somebody's paid that, if they've done the cost at closing, that they're not being given that money back. I mean, that's the bottom line, is we don't want to imply that somehow they're going to get those funds back.
I just want to put this on.
That's right. Why don't we – Mr. Stang can read for the members and then
– Madam Chair, I'd suggest on in two places. Page 5, at the end of on line 25, at the end of the word rescission there, insert, together with any out-of-pocket costs incurred by the lender and paid to third parties in connection with origination of the reverse mortgage loan. That concept is pass-throughs in the business, I think. And I limited it to third-party payments because I didn't think you wanted the bank to be reimbursed for internal costs in the bank for doing the transaction.
Senator Clark is nodding. That's correct.
So that's one place I put it. And then the place that Senator Olson suggested in the notice itself, which is kind of a parallel provision on page 6, at the end of line 2, the same language, together with any out-of-pocket costs incurred by the lender and paid to third parties in connection with origination of the reverse mortgage loan. So I think that I'm not sure it's absolutely necessary, but that gets to the concept people have discussed today.
So Senator Marty would like to move that. Oh, I should have had Senator Wett. Senator Olson.
She can move that.
Okay, no,
Senator Olson. I'll be happy to move that language.
Senator Olson will move that. Any discussion? Senator Clark, that's...
Madam Chair, I think that that's reasonable. We just want to make sure it's clear.
Sometimes
right. Comfort language is good because it's clear.
Right. All those in favor of the Olson amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I want to tell Mr. Bell and Ms. Patterson that this, you know, is still a work in progress in the sense that it will be going to the Judiciary Committee from here if it moves, if we pass it out and recommend it, that it go there. They've asked for it. I think the author was very clear. She doesn't want to dry up the ability of Minnesotans to get a reverse mortgage, and we want to be sure of that too. Is there any further discussion? Senator Marty moves that Senate File 489, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you to everybody who came. And I know Senator Clark will continue to talk to people and listen, and I appreciate. Sorry to everybody.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Pretner Solon.
For a few minutes.
And the meeting's adjourned.